Here on Radio 4 FM, our Book of the Week. Tim Moore has arrived in Milan to begin retracing the roots of the infamous 1914 Giro d'Italia. Armed with journalist Paolo Facchinetti's guide, riding a 1914 Hirondelle road bike and wearing period cycling gear, Tim tells the story of Alfonso Caldazzari and the other riders as they tackle this historic race. Stephen Mangan reads episode 2 of Gironimo, riding the very terrible 1914 Tour of Italy.
I flap-slapped over tram tracks up the deserted flagstone boulevards of Milan, searching for the 1914 Giro start line on the Corso Sempione, guided by a 21st century sat-nav mounted on my crossbar. The venue that hosted the opening ceremony had long since been demolished, and in its place was a seven-story apartment block. I rooted out Paolo's book and looked again at the photo of the riders gathered with their bikes for final registration in their Sunday best, three-piece suits and straw boaters. A test for none but the strong and the desperate. This neatly summarised the dreadful poverty that drove 81 men to the start line. Pre-war Italy was a place of shocking deprivation, and a career in professional cycling was one of the very few routes out of grinding hardship. Amongst the hard-bitten, long-suffering pros were 15 of the rankest of rank amateurs, aspiranti, who turned up in Milan on borrowed bikes. Paolo's book states, most were unemployed. Many may have felt they would at least eat better in the race than they could at home. A crowd of over 10,000 stood along the moonlit Corso Sempione as Milan's clocks struck midnight. Every stage of the 1914 Giro would begin at this extraordinary hour, designed to ensure a well-attended evening turnout when the riders toiled up to the finish line 18 or 19 hours later. I double-checked the safety pin holding my shorts up. Then I slammed shoes into toe clips and eased my behind onto a dead man's saddle. Off the pavement, kerthunk, and steadily away up the desolate, heat-hazed boulevard, northwest into a mighty low sun. As I swung out to overtake a parked bus, my saddlebag fell off, striking some rearward part of the Hirondelle in a manner that caused the back wheel to buck across the shiny flagstones. A corrective yank of the handlebars neatly introduced the front wheel into the slot of an adjacent tram rail, and over we went. My unaccustomed feet did all the wrong things, and I slid gently along the road, with both of them jiggling helplessly in their toe-clip cages. I strapped everything back together and shakily remounted. It was getting dark when I called it a day at Gallarate. Rolling up to the first hotel in town, I felt no more than pleasantly well-exercised, but climbing off the Hirondelle, my legs buckled. Later in the evening, I stooped nude over a hotel bidet and sluiced the residue of human toil from my kit. The 100% wool clung on to its filth and wouldn't even be half dry by morning. The next day introduced one of the unexpected challenges of long-distance touring on a really old bike, getting out on the road before lunch. As I pushed the Hirondelle up the garage ramp, it fell apart like a clown's car. The saddlebag bracket collapsed, then the front wheel somehow worked free of its dropouts. In fact, almost every bolt, screw and spoke that could have loosened itself had done so. By the time the bike and I creaked out into the daylight, it was gone 12. On the plus side, my shorts were almost dry. The sun was high and I stood up in the saddle. When I sat down again, the saddle gave way completely. I turned back and saw the front 2 inches of it in the gutter. I looked down and saw that my nuts were now to be cushioned by a big rusty bolt. I pressed my crochet-gloved hands over my face and screamed. Then I climbed back on the Hirondelle and pedalled away in a semi-erect half-crouch, failing to admire the glittery splendour of Lake Maggiore laid out beneath me. My Giro had started to unravel in almost precise geographical symmetry with the 1914 original. Then, as the storm-sodden peloton rode along the shore of Maggiore, a cry rang out from the darkness. Watch out! Nails in the road! the entire field came to a ragged hissing halt. Sabotage-related punctures were a feature of almost every major race back then. By 1914, this had died down in most European countries, but in impoverished Italy, anti-Giro hostility remained widespread. At the lakeside town of Arona, I set off up a modest thoroughfare that identified itself as Road of the Little Alps. I didn't think there could be such a thing as a little alp, and I was right. The trees turned to pine and the road twisted upwards through them. My hands flapped at gear levers that weren't there. My thighs quivered under a full load. When they could support me no longer, I cautiously lowered my buttocks down onto what remained of the saddle. I found out the hard way that small-town Italy doesn't do lunch, at least not in a form of any use to the dying cyclist. In Italy, it seems everyone goes home for lunch to get their cheeks pinched over a massive bowl of mamma's pasta. I bought the last two packets of crisps in Valdugia and slaked an obsessive thirst for Coca-Cola, the glucose drip in a can. In the 1914 Giro, almost every rider started each stage with one of his bidon filled with Vino Rosso and topped it up whenever possible. I rolled along a hot valley dotted with forgotten towns, decrepit Renaissance palazzos, cheek by dusty jowl with cement works. I bucked over a level crossing and shed two springs from the brake calipers. I was passing a run-down little industrial estate when a sign, Pepe Bike, Tutto per la Bici, led me to the only unit open for business. If I have another child, I hereby vow to christen it Pepe Bike.
Hey, old style!
Giacomo, a cheery gentleman, instantly introduced himself, wheeled the Hirondelle into his cavernous workshop and hoiked it up onto a workstand, cooing and beaming. Giacomo pronounced the old Brook saddle dead. He rooted around under the counter, extracting a replacement. I shook Giacomo's hand and blurted out a farewell message in terrible Italian, which came out as, I now go a tour of Italy to the year 940 by a French bicycle from this epoch. Respectfully yours. Biella, a grubby textile town, presented a suitably drab backdrop to my own travails. I shuffled up the street to a garish parade of clearly unpopular dining establishments. I manfully dispatched a pizza topped with raw oven chips, a necessary carb fest that may rank as the most challenging meal I have ever completed. Out of town, I headed westwards, into the setting sun, towards the Alps. It was properly rural, the air heavy with the muscular smell of rosemary and silage. I stopped at a village shop for what would become my standard late afternoon restorative, a litre of milk and a bar of Milka Extra Cacao. On the approach to Susa, I'd noticed a growing number of roadside tributes to accident victims. Every single one mourned a young man, and I had a good idea how most had met their end. At irregular intervals, a day-glow pack of huge motorcycles would tear deafeningly past. Susa was one of those curiously grubby alpine valley towns. I found a small hotel run by a kindly old couple and took Paolo's book with me to supper to set the scene for my morning challenge, the ascent to Sestriere. Sestriere was already notorious to me as the ascent where Lance Armstrong won his first tour in 1999, speeding ludicrously away from the world's greatest climbers to build an unassailable overall lead. What I hadn't properly grasped was the climb's enormity. From Susa to Sestriere, it is needed an ascent of 40 kilometres, said Paolo. 40? 40? That didn't seem possible. Go uphill for 40 kilometres and you'd surely be in orbit. In 1914, it got worse higher up. The rain turned to sleet, then a full-on blizzard. Defeated by the frosted mud, the surviving riders got off to push their bikes up the path laid by Napoleon's troops 100 years previously. Racers cried like children. This was a calvary, concluded Paolo. The next morning, I cycled several kilometres up and then back down the wrong mountain. an invaluable learning experience that alerted me to the petrifying uselessness of my brakes. I arrived at the foot of this retraced detour with exhaustion and terror battling it out on my features. The right mountain was bigger than the wrong one. Outside Susa, the road ploughed resolutely skywards. The sun bore down from a windless, hard blue heaven. Creaking through Gravere, 1,000 feet above Susa, I plunged my whole mad head, goggles, cap and all, straight into a mossy old fountain trough. Ulx was the last town before the rocky, treeless final haul to Sestriere. I stopped at a petrol station for milk and milker, then toiled up unwelcoming, lumpy highlands set in a blue-skied bowl of craggy peaks. When the 1914 frontrunners reached Sestriere at midday, they expected to find nothing but an obelisk erected to mark the centenary of Napoleon's crossing. But astoundingly, a group of die-hard fans stood in wait for their heroes with hot water and dry clothes. Back then, as Paolo says, nobody ever went up to Sestriere. And they didn't until the 1930s, when the Fiat-owning Agnelli family built a winter resort at the top. I trundled through the hinterland of 1970s ski lodge apartment blocks. Most betrayed the dark and shuttered look of seasonal mothballing. But I found one that didn't. Its front desk was manned by an Eastern European lady.
"So you are a lonely man without friends?"
I agreed that I was.
"I have only big apartment."
She led me to a three-roomed suite. I had to make my own bed with a pile of provided sheets, and the absence of toiletries meant a shower with concentrated detergent, washing my kit underfoot like an aged peasant stamping on wine grapes. For the 1914 boys, a bad day was four punctures in a blizzard. For me, it was walking up a hill and having to make my own bed. I clicked off the light.
"Goodbye to the lonely man,"
said the receptionist as she handed back my passport in the morning. Doubt had been whispering in my ear all the way up this enormous mountain. But going fast downhill is the whole point of cycling, so I pointed the Hirondelle down the mountain. Momentum built unstoppably. Cattle, chalets and frost-cracked mountain tarmac flashed past. My goggles claimed their first victim, a large UFO that splattered the right lens with bits of abdomen. I began to feel strangely detached, as if someone else was enduring this crisis, no doubt because I really, really wished they were. I curled two fingers around each lever and squeezed tentatively, hoping at least to slow down to a pace that might allow me an open casket funeral. Sproink! I shed one of my rear blocks. If you're going to die in a bicycle race, chances are you'll do it by losing control down a mountain. Chances are that mountain will be in Italy. Maurice Garin had won the first Tour de France without any brakes at all, slowing himself via the application of shoe to road. After a soul-freezing brush with oncoming traffic at the first tight bend, I knew there was nothing else for it. 61 kilometres per hour, Gérard Legrost's thin leather soles with my feet inside them hit the deck hard. A very short while later, I scraped to an inelegant halt in a village. There was a bar opposite. I shakily dismounted and tottered inside. There was still an awful lot of Alp to hurtle down.
Episode 2 of Geronimo, Riding the Very Terrible 1914 Tour of Italy by Tim Moore, was read by Stephen Mangan, abridged by Libby Spurrier, and produced by Joanna Green. It's a peer production for BBC Radio 4. The news is next. Then we join Jane Garvey for Woman's Hour.
We've opened the door of an electricity substation, and inside is a kind of bedroom, really.
Modern-day slavery in the UK.
Some shoes are tucked up on top of the high-voltage boxes.
Jane Deeth reports on how the homeless and vulnerable are being used for cheap labour.
Sometimes five, six guys sleep in here at night, and then they get up at the crack of dawn and join the black economy.
Who are they? And how organised are the gangs that prey on them? The new series of File on 4 begins this evening at 8 on BBC Radio 4.